Well, brand names go well beyond the corporate world. Countries have their own brand names, those places that shape a nation's identity. Take England. To many tourists, England means Stonehenge, the Tower of London, Buckingham Palace, the White Cliffs of Dover. Now, to see all those places, you have to go trekking across the country. But what if all of England's great tourist sites, or at least life-size replicas, stood right next to each other in a grand theme park? That is the outrageous premise of Julian Barnes' novel England, England. As Barnes told Steve Paulson, this monumental theme park is the brainchild of the tycoon, Sir Jack Pittman.
It's partly, of course, megalomaniacal fantasy, but it's also the result of two specific touristic insights and commercial principles. One, the notion that tourist traffic between tourist sites has now got so clogged and so dire that you spend a lot of the time going from one famous place to another, wasting time changing hotels.
So why not have them all in one place?
Have them all in one place. Put Harrods inside the replica Tower of London so you can kill two birds with one stone. Have a fleet of black London taxis shuttling you from destination to destination, all of which are free, and they always come when you want one. That's the first convenience. That's the first principle. The second principle is that, and this is, I think, properly attested in the history of modern history of tourism, that given the choice between a convenient replica and an inconvenient original, tourists will generally prefer the convenient replica.
You really? You think that's true?
Yes. Often they don't know it. For instance, you go to Florence, you go to the Piazza della Signoria, you see this magnificent Michelangelo statue of David, slightly disfigured by pigeon droppings on the head, but still. And you look at it for a long time, and it's free, and everyone's milling around it, and then some cynic or novelist comes up to you and says, by the way, it's a replica. And you think, ah, didn't know that. Of course, it is standing exactly where it has always stood for centuries. And then the cynic or novelist tells you that the real thing is actually in a museum, which you would have to walk to. And
then you'd have to stand in a long line.
Stand in line and then pay and see lots of other stuff as well, which you've been told by your tourist guide is lesser masterpieces than this. And you think, well, I've done that. And I think that's fair enough. It's also the case, you see, that the technology of reproduction is getting now so good that the distinction between the replica and the original is getting thinned more and more. That the laser technology can reproduce the famous Elgin marbles, those friezes from the Parthenon, which the Greeks allege that we, the British, stole back in the early 19th century, and we know very well that we bought from the Turks.
So you're saying the Greeks could just have this laser replica and you wouldn't have to fight about it?
Indeed. And what is more, and they have been offered it. They have reproduced several of these sculptures. And I've only seen photographs of them. But you can only tell the originals from the replicas by sort of carbon dating or whatever you do with stone. I don't know if you do that. But to the eye, even to the most careful and distinguished art historical eye, there is no difference between these two.
Well, I want to come back to Sir Jack Pittman and his master plan for creating this replica of the great tourist sites of England. He actually does take over an island, the Isle of Wight, and basically turns the whole thing into a theme park. What's there when he's done with his project?
Oh, well, there's everything that you probably come to England for. That's to say, there are famous old sites like Stonehenge, the Tower of London, Buckingham Palace, the White Cliffs of Dover. Then there are things with human connections like Shakespeare's birthplace, Lady Di's grave. I'm not quite sure, it's not specified whether he gets the original of that or whether he builds a replica. And then, of course, there are certain human, entirely human elements, like a lot of people come to Britain to see the royal family. And so he's in a negotiation for much of the book with the royal family to transfer to the island, and he offers them improved pay and conditions.
So they move from London.
Well, they do. He's got a backup, because he's got people training to be replicas of the royal family if the royal family don't come across. He tries to get the legislature to join him, but for some reason they prefer to stay in London, so he gets a bunch of actors who are completely indistinguishable from masters and betters who govern us.
And then part of the deal is the royal family or the replicas, whoever, would make some brief public appearance every day to the tourists.
Yes, that's right. Their schedule is significantly improved from what it would be in old England, as it comes to be known. That's to say, they don't have to meet other boring heads of state. They don't have to review troops every so often. They can have lots of foreign holidays, but they are encouraged to do a daily appearance on the balcony of the replica Buckingham Palace, in exchange for which they get cash in hand.
Well, you're obviously having great fun here with a lot of this, but I'm not exactly sure who you're making fun of. Are you making fun of the tourists who go to see all of these things, or are you making fun of the English who seem to be so obsessed with these grand bits of their past? Who are you satirizing?
Well, I think everyone should, you know, I'm pretty indiscriminate in my cannon fire. I don't think that anyone should escape, not censure, but sort of mild mockery. I mean, it's also a book, I hope, with some serious ideas beneath the fun. I mean, the great French historian Ernest Renan in the last century said, "Getting its history wrong is part of being a nation," which is a wonderfully profound remark, it seems to me. It's interesting that he didn't say getting its history wrong is part of becoming a nation, because that's perhaps obvious in that when a nation is founded, it necessarily entails setting up myths of usually heroic resistance to an oppressor who is then expelled from the land. But he said, getting its history wrong is part of being a nation. So it's continuing. Part of the glue that holds a nation together is an illusion about how it began and how it continued. It depends on spin, as we say nowadays.
Hmm. Well, I have some sense of what Americans want to see as tourists when they go and visit England. I mean, they want to go to all these places, whether it's Stonehenge or Buckingham Palace or the Tower of London. These are on the tourist trail. Hmm. But how do the English themselves think about these places? I mean, are these considered kind of sacred sites?
Depends where you live, I suppose. The British tend in their own country to visit large stately homes, you know, aristocratic country houses. They like doing that. They like visiting gardens a lot. They like some, obviously there's an overlap between things. You know, the British like pubs just as foreigners like pubs, things like that.
What about you? Do you like going to visit these places?
I hate pubs.
These historic sites.
No, I don't much. It's partly the conditions under which you see them. That's to say they're part of a sort of tourist trail. And it's partly, I still have a gut feeling when I go round a very large country house owned by some peer of the realm who was ennobled in the 17th century or something because he slept with a queen or whatever, or disguised, you know, was like the sort of state troopers looking after the king's mistresses, getting them in and out of the back door. I still get the feeling that this guy stole it from my ancestors somehow.
Your ancestors being
my ancestors,
the common people?
My ancestors not being aristocratic at all. No, I can't. I mean, my ancestors climbed into the middle class about three generations ago. And there is a sense in which, you know, 200 years ago, 100 years ago, these vast estates would have had huge dependent populations living around them. Nowadays, people have, even the aristocracy, have fewer servants, but they've somehow replaced them with, you know, coach loads of the unwashed coming to admire all their stuff. And I still find a certain sort of gut instinct against admiring their stuff.
Julian Barnes is one of England's most celebrated novelists. He talked with Steve Paulson about his satire, England, England.